this is what technology has always done for us. It has always allowed us to produce more with less, or faster or cheaper. And so that's why the mantra that I have is better, faster, cheaper, and safer. Generally speaking, technologies, once they satisfy those four criteria, better, faster, cheaper, and safer, it becomes economically inevitable that it is adopted.
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel and Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
Hello, everyone. Jack here. In this episode, we're zeroing in on AI-driven digital transformation and its effect on ERP organizational culture. In an era where AI is not just an option but a necessity, we'll dissect how this revolution impacts everything from business processes to the core of how organizations operate. We're thrilled to welcome back David Shapiro to the show, an expert in AI and digital transformation. David returns with fresh perspectives on leveraging AI in the business environment. His work continues to influence the way we think about AI, business systems, leadership, and organizational evolution in the digital age. With a proven track record of driving ethical and impactful AI integration into business strategies, David's insights are invaluable. Joining us from North Carolina, David, it's great to have you with us, and I'm so excited to have you back again.
Thanks, Jack. It's good to be back. Happy to dive into everything and looking forward to the conversation.
And David, I must say, I'm so happy for you. I know you're, and I highly recommend your podcast to our listeners. I know you're just knocking it out of the park with your podcast. You're so insightful and your expertise is really tremendous. So I really appreciate the fact that you're sharing that out with people. Invaluable podcast. So listeners, check it out if you get a chance here.
Thank you.
So David, yeah, it's fantastic to have you back with us again. But before we dive into the core topics of today's discussion, can you catch us up on your journey since we last spoke? Could you share some of your updates on your recent work and any new insights or highlights from your adventures in AI and digital transformation? Of course, we'll dive into some of the details here in just a moment, but maybe if you can kind of bring us up to speed on what you've been up to over the last year or so.
Yeah, absolutely. So really quick, you know, 30-second background. My career, I started in information technology, and I worked towards virtualization. So private cloud was kind of my bread and butter, and automation engineering. So I learned a lot of scripting, a lot of automation, kind of supporting kind of the core business, whether it was the finance department, legal, all the tech teams, you know. So as an infrastructure engineer, as an automation engineer, I kind of had a panopticon view of all the companies that I worked for. And then, of course, when AI came out, I said, this is the next big thing. And so I really dived into that head first. And that was about three-ish years ago, I think, that I started my YouTube channel. And it started just with tutorials. You know, here's how to use GPT-3. And so most of my work up until the last time I was on here was about cognitive architecture, kind of prompt engineering, those sorts of things, really looking at it in terms of how do you use this as an automation engine. Now, since then, my work has broadened. I've done some collaborations with the Human AI Empowerment Lab over at Clemson University. I've also done extensive reading and other podcasts looking at the economic impacts, the social impacts, navigating AI safely. And, you know, I appear on quite a few podcasts. I've actually got a few more podcasts that have recently been recorded and upcoming. And that's really kind of the core of my mission, is just helping people understand what's happening, what's coming, and how to navigate it and kind of achieve the more optimal outcomes, which that's what everyone wants, is kind of the best case scenario.
Well, super. Thanks, David. Appreciate that. And for our listeners, bringing David back on was a decision driven by the immense value he brings to the table, especially in AI-driven digital transformation. And clearly, David, your expertise and foresight into how AI can enhance business systems and organizational culture is exactly why NNA knew we needed to dive deeper and get you back on, given some of these changes here over the last few months. So listeners, David's insights are not just theoretical, they're practical, actionable, and proven to drive change. All of us here at the ERP OCJ hope you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human element components of ERP organizational change. And please stay with us till the end. David will give us his gold nugget of advice based on today's conversations, and I will recap today's key discoveries and offer any of my suggestions on how to implement what we've learned. Our conversations on the ERP OCJ are built around the listen and learn approach. It's when you apply what you learn that you begin to move the needle forward. So let's dive in. So David, some of the general, I guess, topics today are basically asking some of the questions that we touched on a little bit in our previous episode with you. And they're also questions that we are getting more and more and more from our clients now. But I want to talk a little bit about the latest developments in AI, talk to you a little bit about standards, regulations, and governance. And then I also would like to talk to you about concerns for human creativity and critical thinking, which is a major area of interest for me. And then I'd also like to explore with you questions regarding AI and education. You know, I see a lot of what we do at Nestle & Associates is really based on effective education. So those are some of the topics I'd like to cover with you. But before we dive in, I would like to get some thoughts on, and I may be opening up a can of worms here for our conversation, but I wanted to ask you a lot of questions in the spirit of two ideas. And the first one is, so I have a book here, David, and I think you're familiar with this, but it was actually published in 2023, and it was by two gentlemen, Dr. Job Landgreeb, I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly. If I'm not, I apologize, and Barry Smith. And just so our listeners know, Dr. Landgreeb is actually going to be on our podcast here, but they did write a book in 2023. So David, if I may, and give me just a moment, but I want to share with you what it says in the book. And I'm working my way through this book. I haven't finished it yet. But on the back of the book, it says this. The book's core argument is that artificial intelligence that could equal or exceed human intelligence, sometimes called artificial general intelligence, is for mathematical reasons impossible. It offers two specific reasons for this claim. One, human intelligence is a capability of complex dynamic system, the human brain and the central nervous system. And two, systems of this sort cannot be modeled mathematically in any way that allows them to operate inside a computer. And then they go on just briefly here. In supporting their claim, the authors marshal evidence from mathematics, physics, computer science, philosophy, linguistics, and biology, setting up their book around three central questions. What are the essential marks of artificial intelligence? What is it their researchers try to do when they attempt to achieve artificial intelligence? And why, after more than 50 years, are our most common interactions with AI, for example, with our bank's computers, still so unsatisfactory? So, David, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but I would like, maybe if you have an initial response to that, great. But maybe as we go through some of these questions I have for you today, if you can maybe do it in the context of keeping this idea in mind.
Sure.
So before we move on, I'll let you have the floor in response to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, their position is it's not uncommon and it's very well defended. And so what I want to do is I'll first start by validating part of their argument. And so this is something that I bring up often, is that math is truly only ever an approximation of the physical world. That I agree on. However, there are several fundamental flawed assumptions of their argument. And I really kind of only need to unpack one of them, I think, and that is the assumption that the human brain is the only way to achieve intelligence. There's not really any evidence of that. I mean, there's multiple animals on the planet that have various levels of intelligence. So we know that neural structures with various form factors, various evolutionary paths can all achieve different levels of intelligence. But then also, just because the substrate is different, and so by substrate, I mean, you know, whether it's running on neurons or silicon chips or whatever, it's still just processing information. If you take a materialist approach and say, okay, all that's happening here is matter and energy is doing something, right? If you remove the idea of like maybe there's an immaterial soul or the mind is separate from the body, if you take a physics first approach, which it sounds like they did, then it's still just information propagating across a physical substrate. And so from that perspective, yes, it's unlikely that we could ever have a perfect simulation of a human brain, but there's not really any evidence that that is required to achieve intelligence. And there was a talk given by one of the members of OpenAI back when he was still at Stanford, I think. And he said, you know, these things only seem to understand. And it's like, well, they seem to understand really well. And they seem to be able to write code. They seem to be able to think. And you could say the same thing about people, or, you know, the people seem to understand. And so there's really this kind of normalcy bias. There's these two phenomena. So one is normalcy bias, which is, this is all I've ever seen in my entire life, so therefore I can't really imagine things being different. And that is, I mean, to be fair, no one alive today has really lived through the kind of revolution that is possible with artificial intelligence. And then the other one is human exceptionalism, which is rooted both in just our basic psychology and our basic experience. We're the smartest animals on the planet, but it's also rooted in cultural paradigms often spoken to in religion. You know, for instance, the Bible says, we are created in God's image and we are special. Now, when you divorce from that idea and you just say, okay, let's take a look at it just from a biological perspective, from a physics perspective, there's actually nothing really secret about us. There's nothing, there's no magic, there's no special materials that go into, you know, our brains or whatever. And so when you understand it, you know, and some scientists say, oh, well, think of us as, you know, biological robots. That's a little bit reductive, but at the same time, there is some validity in looking at, from a first principles perspective, what actually goes into the information that we take in, the processing that happens internally, and then the behavior that we output in the world. Because that model of input, processing, and output is kind of the best way to look at how we handle that information. So I don't personally buy the argument that it is mathematically impossible to achieve human-like intelligence or even superhuman intelligence. Yes, the inner workings will be different at a fundamental level, but really when you look at the objective, the empirical behaviors that result from this kind of intelligence, I don't really think that their argument will stand up to the test of time. Of course, time will tell.
Well, great. Thanks, David. And so my second question for you to kick things off here is, it's a bit futuristic, but I'm going to go for it. But, you know, imagine a world in the near future here where you can drop a piece of AI code within your current ERP platform or within your organization on a, you know, on a tech stack, and it will build a new system around your core system or just start from ground zero. In other words, you won't need a new ERP system or maybe ERP vendors, you know, that world could change dramatically here in the next few years with ERP vendors even going out of business. What's your thoughts on that idea?
Yeah. So, I mean, the kinds of platforms that we're talking about here are some of the largest and most sophisticated platforms that humans have ever built. And so the time that it will take to fully replace them is going to be a while. So from a technologist perspective, first, I would imagine all these existing platforms, whether it's Epic, which is more of a medical, not really, you know, ERP, but it's a similar large platform, they're going to start integrating AI, whether it's Oracle or SAS or other ones. SAS has been one of the world leaders in AI, but they'll start integrating AI into these platforms. But for what you're talking about, kind of imagining what's the next generation of these platforms, what could that look like, you know, if you built it from the ground up? And so kind of a pie in the sky thing that I anticipate will happen eventually, could be within the next 5 years, could be longer, is what's called polymorphic applications. And so a polymorphic application is something where you have an engine that can build other applications. And so the primary thing that I suspect companies are going to be paying for is not the applications, but the thing that builds applications. Kind of like the replicator from Star Trek, except yeah, the replicator for software, right? It's like, hey, right, computer, I need a software platform that handles X, Y, and Z middleware tasks and automates these vendor integrations, and it'll go off and do it. And oh, by the way, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, all of these big shops are working on that kind of software, the very first prototypes of that kind of software, you know, in the background. They're called agents. And so we're going to have these agent platforms, which are going to be able to talk to any API. And when I say they're going to be able to, they already can. This is part of the testing cycle, is not only being able to talk to an API so that you can integrate into any other platform, but then they can also think about what resources do they need? What information do they need to carry out a task? They can do certain levels of planning. And since we're only at the beginning of this technology, it's only going to get better. Now, we're a ways off from those being commercially viable, commercially ready. Microsoft actually interviewed the researcher at Microsoft, Dr. Chi Wang, who is leading the charge there with what's called AutoGen. So they just released AutoGen version 2. Again, this is still just in the tinkering phase. It's not something that I would recommend anyone deploy that has any impact on your bottom line yet, but it's coming. It's a preview of what's coming. And the cash incentive, the impact to your bottom line and your top line, is going to make these kinds of technologies and their successors absolutely imperative to adopt sooner or later.
So, David, let me ask you a follow-up question here then. NNA, Nestle and Associates, and this is a topic of mine that I just really quite passionate interest, and that is the idea and the relationship between people, processes, and technology, right? And as we know in this current day and age, and I know that can be a bit of a buzzword or a bit of a cliche, but it's true. To successfully implement large-scale enterprise software across an organization and to do that effectively and efficient, it really comes down to effective processes in terms of maybe PM tactics and understanding internal processes, but also the right organizational culture and the mindset for the change and, you know, the advocates for such a significant change. And then, of course, it all starts with the foundation, which is the technical system, right? The technical cornerstone in terms of features and functions that allow you to support your people and processes. How do you see, back to my futuristic question here, where you just drop a snippet of code on a machine and it generates a new system? How do you see that dynamic between those three pieces changing here in the next 5-10 years?
So one analogy that I like to use is telephone operators. So at a certain point in time, for all the telephony companies, you had to have, you know, switchboards, telephone operators, just rooms full of people manually making connections. And that was not sustainable. It wasn't sustainable. It wasn't scalable. There was simply just not going to be enough telephone operators. And so what did they do? They had their scientists and engineers go and invent an entirely new approach. And so this is the kind of creative destruction that we will probably expect to see, where a lot of people, and I get this kind of feedback a lot, where someone's like, oh, well, it's not really possible to automate away my job because I do X, Y, and Z, and I have to know, you know, 8 million things, and I know a bunch of people. But the thing is, think about how email could replace much of the postal service. And so whether it's horses and trains and boats, there's a whole raft of infrastructure that you just no longer need when you switch from post to email. Likewise, there's a whole lot of infrastructure and a whole lot of people that you just don't need because you replace it with a fundamentally different approach with the plain old telephone systems and digital voice over IP. And so this is the kind of what's called a saltatory leap that we should expect as AI systems get more and more developed and sophisticated, is they'll just preempt the need for a lot of current jobs. Now, of course, the big question is, will this create new jobs in the same way that, you know, we don't have telephone operators anymore, we don't have typing pools anymore, but we have plenty more office workers. But the thing that I really kind of think about is, okay, if these AI agents and these AI tools get that much smarter, why would that job go to a human when the machine might be cheaper, faster, and safer than a human? So that's kind of one of the big things to keep in mind. And we're already seeing some evidence across the board headcount reduction in some departments. So out there in the news, there have been call centers that have replaced a huge chunk of their staff, you know, 90% reduction by switching to AI-enabled chatbots. And in some cases, the CSAT scores actually go up drastically over, you know, humans. And so now it's not even a matter of retraining humans. It's this new approach subverts even the need for a human in that role, which that's good for the bottom line. That's good for investors. Humans are expensive to employ. But that similarly causes a lot of anxiety and resistance in employees. There was another study, I think this one was actually by MIT, that showed that the more employees use AI, the more they fear for their job. Because over time, as employees use these new AI tools, they realize, wait, I'm not using my brain as much. Why am I here? And so they kind of see the writing is on the wall. And so there's the kind of two primary reactions is one, skepticism, and then two, fear or anxiety. It's kind of, you know, two sides of the same coin. And so from a people, processes, and technology standpoint, the technology sells itself. It is super compelling. And once you find that use case where it's like, oh, hey, it either makes us two times more productive or it reduces headcount, you know, whatever, it has some direct impact on the bottom line. The technology sells itself. It would be like, you know, imagine you have a motor pool and you say, well, actually, we're going to go back to horse and carriage. That argument just doesn't make sense. And in many cases for companies, whether it's, you know, small entrepreneurs as small as myself to SMBs and enterprises, it's kind of like once you go to AI, you never really go back. And so the technology sells itself. The people that transformation, I think, is going to be one of the most difficult and one of the most painful aspects. Right now, unemployment is still really good in terms of it's relatively low. But, you know, as we see things transforming into the future, it remains to be seen as to whether or not these jobs dislocations will result in more employment elsewhere. And then, of course, the processes themselves, kind of implied in all this, is you find a fundamentally different process to achieve the same or better result, is kind of what I'm talking about with this this wholesale rip and replace in terms of deploying new systems that turn your business velocity up to 11.
Well, interesting. Thanks, David. Could you maybe give our listeners an overview of the latest developments in AI that you find most exciting or transformative?
Yeah, so there's two right off the top of my head. So the first one is a video model by OpenAI called Sora. And I don't think that's an acronym, it's just S-O-R-A. So Sora produces, it's not quite perfect video, but it produces high resolution video at 4K. And it's what's called a text to video model, where you just type in a scene that you want, and then it goes off and generates it. And, you know, a few minutes later, gives you up to a minute long 4K, so high definition video of what you asked for, including sound, I think. I haven't had a chance to use it yet. It's still in the kind of private beta rollout. But this technology, and I predicted this more than 2 years ago in my first book, so it's right on time, right on schedule. This technology, for instance, one, is going to be great for marketers, because it's, hey, instead of having to set up, you know, a $20,000 a day photo shoot, you say, here's a few pictures of the product that we're selling, put it on a model, you know, here's a new commercial. Boom, you're done, right? And so that is going to be good for marketers. It's bad for, you know, the actors, the voiceover artists. It's bad for a lot of people, but it's good for the business's bottom line. Now, personally, as one of my primary hobbies is I'm a sci-fi author, so I'm waiting another year or two, and then I'm going to translate my novel into a 4K, you know, Hollywood-looking, you know, blockbuster, yeah. And I'm going to do it for less than $1,000.
Wow.
Like, it's really difficult to wrap your mind around the cost differences. Now, the other innovation is Claude 3 just came out. So Claude 3 is the latest chatbot by a company called Anthropic. And so Anthropic AI, they were actually founded by people who left OpenAI because they were concerned about the safety practices at OpenAI. Now, so they train their chatbot with a fundamentally different paradigm. Well, a few fundamentally different paradigms. There's some convergence in the industry as well. But Claude 3 has basically shocked a lot of people. There are a lot of postdoctoral researchers out there in domains ranging from physics to quantum computing and others. And these researchers have given Claude maybe their thesis or their current work, and it is able to effectively help them with their research. And so when you think of, like, okay, someone who's doing advanced physics, someone who's doing frontier mathematics, someone who's doing quantum computing, these are things that there's only a few thousand people on the planet qualified to do that level of research, and they are impressed by this new tool. And we're only just getting started. And so this is a small hint of what's to come in terms of the capabilities of these machines. Now, are there going to be diminishing returns? I suspect we will see diminishing returns, but the people building these things, they say we're nowhere near the plateau. We're still before even the exponential ramp up. So imagine a sigmoid curve. If you haven't seen a sigmoid curve, it's vaguely S-shaped. So it starts low, it ramps up, and then it tapers off near the top.
Yeah.
We're not even at the middle of the sigmoid curve yet in terms of what this technology is ultimately going to be capable of.
Crazy. So, David, with AI evolving so rapidly, just in general, how do you see these advancements influencing global technological standards and practices?
So we're going to see a fragmentation. Well, we already are seeing a fragmentation where about a year ago, there was a lot of talk about, you know, just keeping everything open source. And then when all the tech companies started realizing, oh, like, we're playing with fire now, they started going more closed source. And this is natural. If you have valuable IP, you should, you know, according to business practices, close it up, package it up, resell it. Whatever your secret sauce is, you sell it. The recipe for KFC, right? The recipe for Coca-Cola. You keep that secret and you make money on that. Now, some other companies have taken a different approach where they realize that the AI is just part of the service they're offering, and they're not selling the AI itself. So the biggest example out of Silicon Valley is Meta or Facebook. So they have decided to do most of their work open source. Why? because Mark Zuckerberg cares more about social media and the metaverse rather than just selling AI for its own sake. So that's kind of the two primary approaches that we're seeing in terms of how companies are approaching this. But you're also going to see a lot of competition and, by extension, a little bit of fragmentation before the market kind of comes back together and consolidates around new best practices. For anyone in the tech space, you might remember about 2 decades ago when Bluetooth was invented. Yeah. Nobody knew what to use Bluetooth for. People were saying, oh, you're going to be able to talk to your dishwasher. Who wants to talk to their dishwasher? Now we know how to use Bluetooth. Mm-hmm. Likewise, this area is so new and it's evolving so fast, we don't really know where it's all going to be used. So that's what I mean by fracturing, and then eventually we'll converge on the best practice. But I don't think we're really anywhere near best practices yet.
Got it. And David, you mentioned earlier regarding Claude 3 that folks left due to concerns. And, you know, obviously AI's potentials seem boundless, right? But so do its risk, in my view. What are the latest conversations around AI safety and ethics that you think our listeners should be aware of?
So it depends on who you talk to and who you listen to. If you listen to the establishment, and by the establishment, I mean NIST, you know, National Institute of Standards and Time, or technology, or the government. This is basically just being treated as, you know, same stuff, different day. You know, it's just another new gizmo. And I think that is fundamentally underselling the magnitude of this technology. Now, just because that's what the government and the big players are saying publicly, I don't necessarily think that they know that internally. I think that internally, many of these establishment organizations, whether they're public or private or otherwise international, I think they kind of see the writing on the wall. But most people out there that you talk to have no idea what is happening, what's going on, and what's coming. And so because of this huge, huge distribution in terms of how oriented people are to this technology and this change that's coming, you have to be very careful with your public messaging. And so because of that, it's really kind of difficult to get a read as to who thinks what and what they truly believe versus what they're publicly saying. And I know that might sound a little bit cynical, but it wouldn't be the first time there's been a major disconnect between kind of what's going on behind the scenes, what the conversations happening in closed door meetings versus the public messaging. But again, that's kind of what I mean by the fragmentation that's going to happen as people kind of get caught up to speed with the magnitude of this change. And then the conversation will change. So having been in this space before ChatGPT, there was a huge, huge sea change that happened with the release of ChatGPT. Before ChatGPT, you know, I would talk to people and I was like, have you heard about GPT-3? And people are like, what are you talking about? And nobody knew what a language model was. And nobody knew like what generative AI was. After ChatGPT, the conversation changed drastically. And so probably what's going to happen is every time there's a big release where a new product comes out, a new service comes out that will really kind of convince people, okay, we've taken the next big step. But again, it really depends on who you talk to. In terms of how oriented they are to the space as to, you know, what their beliefs are. But it changes in steps.
And David, you mentioned the idea of being cynical. And I have to admit, you know, sometimes I find myself being a little bit cynical as I try to maneuver my way through the AI sphere as well. But isn't there an economic factor here as well, regardless of where AI goes in the future, you know, good, bad, or ugly? Isn't there a great deal of money to be made right now from AI? And could part of that be, you know, just talking about ethics and AI control? And I'd like to ask you some questions on governance here in just a moment. But, you know, there's a lot of money to be made right now from AI and AI development and where it could take us. What's your thoughts with that?
Yeah. So a little bit more nuanced take. Generally speaking, technology lowers the cost of goods and services. That's why we do it, right? You use a tractor instead of a bull, because the tractor does more and costs less in the long run. Yes, it's more complicated, it's more sophisticated, but if it breaks down, you just fix the engine, you call the mechanic, and it's back up. You know, if your bull breaks a leg, you shoot him and you have to wait a few years or go spend a few $1,000s to get another bull or ox or whatever. So this is what technology has always done for us. It has always allowed us to produce more with less, or faster, or whatever, or cheaper. And so that's why the mantra that I have is better, faster, cheaper, and safer. Generally speaking, technologies, once they satisfy those four criteria, better, faster, cheaper, and safer, it becomes economically inevitable that it is adopted. In some respects, you could say it would be ethically required to adopt it. Because here's an example. Let's say you go back, you know, two centuries and you look at the way that medical procedures and surgeries were done, and it was, you know, basically still the Dark Ages. They didn't really know anything about, or not as much about anesthetics, and certainly not as much about hygiene. And once you can do it better, faster, cheaper, and safer with modern surgical tools, modern monitoring equipment, modern antibiotics and that stuff, you're ethically required to do it the new way.
All right, David, I would like to ask you some questions along another topic that we are getting more and more questions on, and that is around AI regulations and governance. What key developments have you seen in this area just over the last year?
So regulations at the federal and international level are lagging way, way behind in terms of what is possible today. Now, this is not really a surprise, particularly in America, because we have more of a reactive approach to regulation, whereas the EU has a more proactive approach. And so the EU AI Act, I think it was recently ratified, or it's close to being ratified at this point, has been seen as kind of overly heavy-handed with its definitions in terms of what constitutes high-risk AI versus low-risk and other thresholds for regulation. But also one of the key problems from my perspective is, and it's not a problem, it's a good thing to include, but it's too limited, is they focus primarily on consumer protections rather than broader systematic problems, such as broader safety risks. Now, there has been some advancement here, particularly in the private sector, which is focusing on CBRN. So that's chemical, biological, radioactive and nuclear? Or that sounds redundant. Anyways, it's a pattern of kind of what are the greatest threats that AI has? If you put a powerful AI in the hands of an adversarial actor, whether it's a hostile nation or a terrorist organization, how can they use it to do harm? It can range from launching cybersecurity attacks, which many models have already been demonstrated to be capable of compromising websites and aiding hackers by writing scripts. And there's even been some evidence of viruses that are AI enabled or AI augmented viruses, cyberspace attacks, aiding with the creation of bioweapons, for instance, understanding and building nuclear weapons, whether it's the bomb itself or rockets and that sort of thing. So those are kind of the biggest risks that the industry has consolidated on. Now, fortunately, pretty much every government and every international organization already has a framework for how do you handle these kinds of threats. Because from bioweapons to cybersecurity to nuclear weapons, these are nothing new. It's just AI is kind of another tool in the toolbox for anyone who wants to do harm with these. So with that respect, I am a little bit more pleased to see the direction that things are going at a federal level. And here's where my thoughts are a little bit more, I don't want to say conspiratorial, but reading between the lines, I think the reason that in particular the American government is kind of slow walking any regulation is because the last thing that they want to do is throw cold water on progress, namely because of geopolitical tension with China. China is full steam ahead on AI. They are still behind us. At the same time, many of the best papers that are published are from Chinese authors. And so there's a lot at stake here on the world stage with respect to artificial intelligence. And as Vladimir Putin said a few years ago, whoever wins the AI race basically wins geopolitics for the next several decades, if not several centuries, or permanently. So the stakes are very high. But from a business perspective, it's all gas, no brakes.
Yeah. I was going to say, David, doesn't it have to be an all or nothing type of thing? That is, how do you envision global cooperation shaping the future of AI regulation, and what challenges might arise in achieving international consensus? Because it does seem to me like it's got to be almost an all or nothing type of scenario.
Yeah. And so our best framework, for instance, on international regulation of something dangerous is nuclear weapons. And of course, we have non-proliferation agreements and those sorts of things. But here's the thing. It's not a one-to-one comparison. When you look at the utilitarian function of nuclear weapons, they are only destructive and only serve as strategic deterrents. And so because of that, they don't really have any other use. You build a nuclear stockpile and then you let it sit, and your ability to launch nuclear weapons means that you're not going to get attacked. Great. It's a one-trick pony, basically. Artificial intelligence is almost the opposite. So far, AI has only been useful. Yes, it's been disruptive, but it's only given us art and music and writing code. It just wants to be useful to us. And so here we have this superpower that has up to this point, no real downsides, except for a few people out there that are saying, you know, AI is going to kill us all, which it could. I'm not really in that camp, and I've talked to people who are. And yes, it does have the potential to be dangerous, but it's dangerous in the same way that any technology or any science is dangerous. When you invent dynamite, you can blow more things up. When you invent nuclear weapons, you can blow more things up. With artificial intelligence, now the entities that we're building, whether they're robots or agents or, you know, automation platforms, they have what I call functional sentience. They can behave more agentically or autonomously, which is an entirely new set of paradigms in terms of how they can behave. And sorry, I kind of took that down a rabbit hole. Hope that answered your question.
It did. Yeah, thank you. So, David, from your perspective, what are the essential elements of effective AI governance that can balance innovation with societal safety?
So on the level of individual corporations, I mean, again, many, many existing frameworks exist in terms of, you know, don't harm your customers, don't harm your consumers, pay your taxes, those sorts of things. Now, and it depends on how much responsibility you want to take from a governance perspective. I've talked to a lot of people who want to kind of tap the brakes and make sure that companies don't start laying off people too quickly. And whenever I have people suggest that to me, I said, yes, that would be optimal. But, you know, Silicon Valley is famous for laying off up to 10% of its workforce per year, sometimes 12% per year. And so it's not really, I don't think that it's a realistic, even if it would be ideal, it would be realistic because, again, if your competitor is going to start laying people off with workforce transformations, you have to if you want to remain competitive. And because the AI regulations, as I mentioned, are more reactive than proactive, I suspect that it's going to be relatively painful for some people sooner rather than later. Now, it's not going to happen all at once, I don't think. There are certain types of jobs, there are certain types of industries that are more vulnerable than others. For instance, marketing, copywriting in particular, we're already seeing in the freelancer space, the number of jobs for freelance writers and copywriters and marketers has gone way, way down. And I've even talked to other entrepreneurs whose clients are saying, hey, we're going to let you go soon. We're doing everything that you're doing, but we're going to do it with AI. Now, we've seen this kind of thing happen before, for instance, with offshoring. You know, during the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a huge rush to offshore as much as you could to, say, for instance, India. But after a while, we realized there was limitations with that paradigm. And so now onshoring is a thing. Likewise, there's probably going to be an overcorrection where some people kind of go all in on AI and then find there are some limitations where it's just better to keep a human in the loop. And then they you know, dial it back and hire some people back. These kinds of things happen as natural experiments emerge. But then in terms of internal governance, the way that some of the guidance that we've gotten from the government, and this very closely parallels with kind of what I've been saying for a while, is basically you appoint a chief AI officer. This is kind of what Biden's executive order from, what was it, last November, I think, basically said that like all government departments need to have some head honcho who's responsible for AI strategy. And so by hiring someone or appointing someone internally who is responsible, who's going to be your AI czar in terms of safety, ethics, innovation, or whatever, that's going to be kind of the way to go forward. Now, one thing that has been interesting that I've heard rumors of out there is that there are many innovation officers, CIOs, chief innovation officers, that are still kind of overwhelmed by AI. And some of them kind of have their head in the sand where they don't really believe it's a thing, or they're taking a wait and see approach. But those companies that are a little more forward thinking and already hiring a VP or executive VP of AI, they're going to be doing better. So one of my clients, one of my biggest clients as a AI consultant, they had this exact problem about 6 months ago where they were looking for someone to head up their AI efforts. And after interviewing for a few months, they couldn't find anyone. And so they said, well, what do we do? And I said, if you have someone internally, you look for someone who is hungry for this, who eats, sleeps, and breathes it, because there is no substitute for passion. So you hire for personality and then promote them. And that client has actually done really well. And their new head of AI, I still talk with them pretty much every other week. And they're very happy. They're so incredibly happy to be at the cutting edge of this. And they're constantly asking me the same kind of questions that you're asking, which is, how do we do this safely? What are the competitors doing? How do we stay at the cutting edge? And I think to kind of what you implied a little bit ago, was we should expect some companies to go the way of the dinosaurs. Some of this is going to be structural, where the business model is just completely invalidated. In other cases, it's going to be failure to adapt. At the same time, there's going to be brand new companies up and coming that are AI first.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the whole idea, I think, David, at this point, AI is not going anywhere, right? So, I mean, organizations need to really start understanding what it is, where it's heading. You know, you talked about a CIO, Chief Innovative Officer. And I think now is certainly the time to start thinking about that, right? And I think those organizations that think they may be not have to worry about AI or what's in the near future, I think they're probably not quite understanding what's coming.
Right.
David, let me ask you this. This is a big one for me, and it's just difficult for me to get my arms around this. And my perspective on this honestly changes almost daily. But if we could, let's just talk for a moment about the human side of the equation. And that is, you know, there's a growing conversation about AI's impact on human creativity and critical thinking. What's your take on this? I know you alluded to it a little bit earlier in the conversation, but what's your take on the impact of AI and what is it going to do in terms of human creativity and critical thinking? And really quick, David, it just makes my skin crawl to think that thought leaders or people can use AI to become a thought leader when they're really not, or to create this incredible work of art when it's not from an artist at all, right? I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I'll take the creativity side first. And first, what I'll say is every time that there has been a new media technology, there has always been a crisis in the arts. So, and this goes back to the invention of the printing press and the rise of novels. So if you were a proper Victorian gentleman or lady, you did not read novels. It was considered unethical and immoral because it was you could read everything from subversive ideas about how to raise children to how to approach your marriage and sexuality. And so, you know, there was what's called the penny dreadful, right? It was cheap tripe novels that were published en masse back in, you know, Victorian England. And they thought that they honestly thought that novels were going to cause the unraveling of the fabric of society, much like how we thought that video games were going to do that in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Of course, novels are now commonplace. And nobody really debates about that. Well, I guess there's a few political factions that want to ban books, but you know, people that burn books, they typically don't last that long. Likewise, debates around video games. Yeah, there's some pros and cons to video games. Certainly, video game addiction is a thing, but it's not causing the collapse of society. So every time that there is a technological change, you always have people gatekeeping. So whether it is artists, like graphic artists, saying, "Hey, like, you need to do this by hand. If you don't do it by hand, it's not quote unquote real art." Painters said the same thing with the rise of photography. And then photographers said the same thing with the rise of digital art in the first place. And so what happens, though, is you have an expansion of the arts over time. We actually have more art in the world today than ever before. We have more artists in the world than ever before. And we have more modalities of art than ever before. Then you divide fine art, so like art with a capital A, or fine art, which is art for its own sake, versus commercial art. Commercial art we are used to. That is Hollywood, that is syndicated TV, that is, you know, pictures and paintings like stock footage that you use for business purposes. None of that is like, that's just going to get cheaper, right? Like, I use Midjourney all the time for my YouTube videos, for my thumbnails. That makes my job cheaper, easier, and faster. Likewise, generative art from the creative perspective is going to make business cheaper, leaner, faster, so on and so forth. Now, it's going to be really awful for the people that are going to lose their jobs because of that. However, it's not really going to change our relationship with fine art. And so what I mean by that is, as an example, I mentioned earlier that I'm an author. So my novel is with the editors for the final pass. It was entirely written by hand, the hard way, the long way. And then I paid, you know, an editor for developmental editing. That was a human. And now I'm paying a copy editor to do the final pass. So this, as an expression of my truth, the story that I wanted to tell, has nothing to do with artificial intelligence. Now, you know, is Amazon and Netflix, are they going to start churning out AI-generated content? Almost certainly. But again, commercial art is nothing new. This is just another tool to generate commercial art, but we will always prefer fine art and real experiences. So another example that I like to give is, you have literally billions of songs at your fingertips with Spotify and iTunes. People still go to concerts. You still go to the orchestra. You might not go as often. People also, even though you have Netflix and Amazon and all those other things, people still go to stage plays. People still go to the theater because there is something quintessentially human that is very important to us about connecting with other humans. And this is a concept that collectively I call the meaning economy. So right now we're in a service-based economy. And one thing that I predict is going to transition is, yes, the service economy will always exist. It's going to change drastically, but we're going to see the rise of a new kind of economy. And that's what I call the meaning economy. And that fine art is part of that. There's other aspects of that, but I consider myself part of the meaning economy because that's what I do with my podcast is I help people understand what does it mean? What does it mean to be human in this space? And what does it mean to us philosophically, spiritually, politically, economically, and so on? I'll pause there in case you have any thoughts.
No, that's great. Thank you. So I would like to, and I really appreciate your time. This has been a great conversation. But before I let you go, I have about two or three more questions I'd like to pick your brain on. And one is regarding AI and education. And, you know, as I'd mentioned, I think those of us that know Nestle and Associates and our approach to large-scale ERP organizational change, it's heavily focused on this idea of education and effective and efficient education. But education is another sector profoundly affected by AI. And based on your observations, how is AI being integrated into educational practices today?
So in the K-12, and so I've actually on one of my podcasts, my Systems Thinking podcast, I've interviewed several educators. Just over a year ago, I went on a spree and had about two dozen conversations with educators from all over the world with respect to artificial intelligence and how education is supposed to go. So right now, what we're already seeing at the K-12, so primary education, is that many, many teachers are using tools like ChatGPT to help with creating tests and even getting feedback on writing assignments and so on. Many teachers in many school districts have banned it. They say they don't even want to deal with it. And so they're kind of, you know, doing the stick their head in the sand act, the ostrich routine to just pretend like it doesn't exist. Now in higher ed, there's a little bit more interesting conversation. So one of my good friends is a physics professor, and she was one of our conversations. She's like, this is an arms race. We're not going to win. Like you cannot fight the power of AI. Students are going to use it. And so one thing that we're seeing particularly in higher ed is just integrating into the curriculum. So an example that my wife told me about was a professor who said, okay, use ChatGPT to write your history essay. I know that you're going to do it anyways. And then what we're going to do is we're going to figure out how to prove where it was wrong. And so they're still engaging their critical thinking by not just writing it and turning in the assignment, but writing the essay and then validating it, challenging it, and being very critical about what did it get right? What did it get wrong? What prompting strategies did you use to get the right answer? And how do you know that you have the right answer? And so this is just a fundamentally different orientation towards technology. Now, one thing that I will say is, because I've been thinking about this a lot, there's a lot of fans in my community that have small children. And so I get questions about like, how do you raise a small child in this and what's it going to do? And so I've been thinking, what are some of the quintessential skills that I think that we probably ought to invest more in and probably could invest more in the mind of next small children today growing up, and you know, eventually they'll inherit the world from us. And so one is math. Math creates structural changes in the brain. And so it's not even a matter of using it. It's like, yeah, you might never use it, but the act of learning math makes useful changes in your brain. The other one is communication broadly. And so when I say communication broadly, I mean reading, writing, rhetoric, negotiation, conflict navigation, relationship building, relationship repair. Those are all things that are quintessentially human skills. And, you know, as any entrepreneur will tell you, they are also the most valuable skills. They are far and away the most valuable skills that you will ever have with respect to navigating the business world, navigating a home life, connecting with children, connecting with strangers and friends. And so basically, I kind of figured this out by asking myself, if I had a four-year-old today, and I was going to homeschool them in light of AI and all the changes it's going to make, I would say math and communication, you know, slash relationships. And beyond that, I would make sure that they can read, that they can use the tools, and that, you know, I give them enough knowledge about the world to know, like, hey, just because you can get on TikTok doesn't mean it's a good source of information, for instance. So information and media literacy are very important. But those are the core skills that I think that I would focus on training. Now, when you take a step back, also, I've had dozens, if not hundreds, of college students reach out to me and say, "Hey, I'm about to wrap up my degree in computer science or math or whatever." And they say, what should I learn? And I say, English. Like, learn communication, learn to read, write, learn to express yourself very clearly. And one student was very deeply confused. He's like, "You mean just so that I can like pass interviews?" And I said, "No, these are language models. If you're not an expert in language, you're falling behind." And he's like, I could tell he was a little bit dejected. It wasn't the answer he was expecting from an influencer on the topic. But then he came back a couple weeks later and shared a tweet from one of the main researchers. It was probably Ilya Sutskever or whatever, who said, English is going to be the programming language of the 21st century. And he's like, "You were right." And I was like, "I told you." So learn communication. That is far and away the most important skill that anyone can be focusing on at any age right now. And it's going to be even more important as the economics of things change and what makes you valuable as a human, not just to, you know, companies, but in your community, in your family, and so on.
So that's interesting, David, because I really do believe that the idea of creativity, which you elaborated on a little bit, you know, critical thinking, and then AI's use in education are, in my mind, profound in terms of the impact with AI on the human species. And, you know, a lot of people are overwhelmed by AI, clearly. And, you know, you got the really optimist and the pessimist and everything in between, as you mentioned earlier. But AI makes me think of a book I read years ago, and you may be familiar with it, but it's called Mind, Machines, and Human Consciousness. And I'm drawing a blank on the author right now, and I apologize, but I'll put it in the show notes. But in that, it stated, it wasn't the author, but it was somebody that I believe he interviewed. But he said that someday man is going to be to machines as dog is to man today. And I think it all starts by, this with humans, and if we lose our ability to learn how to utilize AI to still be extremely creative and be reflective in terms of critical thinking, and then really making sure that we are educating our children in the most effective and proper way. I don't know. I'm still, it sounds to me like you're more of a half glass full type of guy. And I'm not saying I am or I'm not, but just to kind of wrap up these questions around creativity, critical thinking, and education. And I have one more question for you today, but it sounds like you're fairly optimistic about that.
Oh yeah, I am. I'm kind of an eternal optimist. My entire career was predicated on my belief that all problems are solvable, and I have the track record to prove it. Mm-hmm. Time and again, I would get roped into a call where, "Hey, we're losing $1 million an hour," and I'm like, "Okay, what's the priority? Do you want to get back online? Do you want to, you know, get to the root cause?" And invariably, of course, you know, directors and VPs are like, "We want to get back online. We need to make sure that we're selling." So high pressure, high stakes. That's kind of, you know, my home base. And yeah, there's no problems out there that I have seen that are unsolvable. There are complex problems. There are complicated problems. And of course, we will change. This is one thing: is our way of life today will probably not exist in 20 years. Our lifestyle will be as different then as it was from, you know, two centuries ago when most of us would have been farmers. Now, what's it going to look like exactly? I don't really know. It's going to be different and it's going to be interesting. And it's also possible that there will be a little bit of trials and tribulations to get there. But again, I don't see any problems that are fundamentally unsolvable.
So, David, I really appreciate this incredibly insightful conversation in your insight as usual. But as we wrap up and before I let you go, I really would like to ask you for your golden nugget. And given all that we discussed today, which was quite a bit, I know it was a pretty broad conversation, everything from the future of ERP systems to humans and critical thinking and education. But how would you summarize this conversation today? And what key takeaways can you provide with our listeners, both in terms of AI in general and where we're headed? You know, obviously, again, there's a lot of people out there that are so concerned and full of fear and anxiety. And then there's other people out there that are just saying, "Hey, hang on and enjoy the ride, because it's, you know, on the other end, it's going to be a great world." But what do you have to say about that? And then also in terms of just, business systems in general for organizations, what should they consider? So that was a mouthful, but how would you, if it's even possible, kind of summarize this conversation today for our listeners?
So brief summarization, I would say, look to the past for inspiration about how to engage with the future. This isn't the first industrial revolution we've gone through. It's not the first technical revolution we've gone through. It's not the first economic revolution that we've gone through. Humanity has gone through many, many transformations in the past, ranging from, ancient Greece and Rome to the Golden Age of Islam to the Enlightenment and the industrial revolutions. We've gone through this before, and we've survived every time. In that respect, it is a very interesting and privileged time to be alive, but it's not going to be without its challenges. And so with that in mind, I would say that the key principle is conscientious courage. And so what I mean by conscientious courage is stay skeptical, engage critically with everything that you hear and see, but don't let the fear and skepticism and doubt, whether it is normalcy bias, whether it is human exceptionalism, don't let that cloud your judgment, and really engage with what's happening at a deep level. And if you're ready, willing, and able, you can really be part of the transformational force that's coming. And rather than being, kind of wiped out by the wave, you could probably, get on top of it and surf it and have a lot of fun. Yes, a lot of people are going to get creamed by the wave that's coming, as always happens. But with that amount of energy, there's also a tremendous amount of potential and opportunity.
David, a huge thank you for sharing your wisdom with us once again. I really do appreciate it. As promised, listeners, that wraps up another enlightening episode. Today, we've ventured into the latest in AI development, standards, regulations, and governance, and we examine the critical balance between AI and human creativity in critical thinking and in education. And we also discussed how AI could impact business systems and organizations. David's insights show how these elements are not just shaping the future of technology and businesses, but also transforming the very essence of ERP systems and business systems and organizational values and cultures. So to our listeners, we encourage you to take what you've learned today and think about how you can apply these insights to move the needle forward in your own ventures, whether it's integrating AI into your own ERP strategies, navigating a complex landscape of digital regulations, or fostering an environment that balances technological innovation with human creativity. There's so much potential to create impactful change. And I think to take David's last golden nugget to heart would be a great place to start. So remember, the future is not just about adapting new technologies, but understanding how these tools can enhance our human capabilities and transform us as a people, and certainly our organizations for the better. So let's use these insights to drive meaningful progress in our fields and in our futures. David, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, my friend. And you've been so kind to Nestle and Associates to share your great work and your insight. Before we go, can you remind our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
There's pretty much only two ways today. So first is my primary podcast platform is on YouTube. So just look for Dave Schapp or David Shapiro on YouTube. I have five channels now, and you can, once you find one of them, you can get to the rest of them. And then for anyone who wants to join my webinars, so I have two monthly webinars. One is Humanity. So that's on the first Friday of the month. We talk about kind of the social, political, philosophical impacts of everything that is changing. And then on the third Friday, I have more of a technical and business-oriented webinar on AI. And all of that is available through my Patreon, which I think that Jack will probably have in the show notes for you.
Yeah, absolutely. We will include all of that in our show notes for sure. Thanks again, David. Really appreciate it. Be well. And we'll certainly talk soon and be in touch.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, and great conversation, and happy Friday.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERPOCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.